Welcome to Influential She, the podcast about accelerating the influence of women in the world.
You will find us to be a fresh voice in an old conversation.
And here we are, your amazing co-hosts, Deb Soholt
and Mel Schopp.
Well, hi, everyone, and welcome back to this episode of Influential She. This is our conversation about accelerating the influence of women in the world. I'm your co-host, Deb Soholt.
And I'm Mel Schopp, and today we're going to talk about probably the core of the work that we did initially, Deb, don't you think? We're talking about the high leverage practice of self. Our byline on this one is being completely who you are and living out your values. And sometimes I think this is something that is just like, it seems so hard to do.
Absolutely, Mel. And I think, you know, just really being authentically yourself and knowing yourself, it's just lifetime work. But this is one of, I mean, even every day I'm thinking, am I showing up authentically? Is this like really grounded in what my values are? Is this the way I want to play out my life? And so I think, but we both could recognize like early in our lives, in our careers, in our professional moving forward, in establishing our families, our relationships and community, that if we had spent more time on this high leverage practice of self, and really started to connect with, this is what makes my heart sing instead of what makes somebody else think my heart would sing, that we would have really seen ourselves in a different way and really established a whole new confidence.
And I think that when we do that, people are really drawn to that authenticity. I think that that's the one thing that people, when they really see that you're being authentic in who you are, that's what really leverages influence. And that's exactly who our guest is. So, you know, I'm really excited today to introduce Lisa Mitchell and talk about somebody who truly let her true authentic selves come through in her career and her life and in the initial call we had with you. So welcome, Lisa, today to our podcast. We're just thrilled to have you here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to our chat.
Yeah. So Lisa, the original title, I was looking at your title, which is pretty impressive. It's a long one, so bear with me. It's the director of education and audience engagement at Disney Theatrical Group. It's like, wow, what a cool title.
It's a mouthful.
Yeah, it is a mouthful. In addition to that, you have this amazing title behind you that you just received your doctorate at Johns Hopkins University in developing, you know, it's specific to developing enduring theater programs under resource schools. So I'm just thinking about, wow, this woman who has all this deep education background. But in our pre-call, you started out and you said, I embrace education with a lowercase e. Can you explain that to our audience? Because I think that was surprising to me. I mean, obviously, you're a very well-educated woman, but explain a little bit about your education, your background that made that statement.
You know, it's actually interesting because I was quite a bad student growing up. I had the good fortune of going to very good public schools for my childhood, and my parents gave me every opportunity to explore my talents and what I was interested in. But in an traditional academic setting, I just did not thrive. In elementary school, I was evaluated to see if I needed some, you know, additional support, especially when it came to mathematics and numeracy. And I struggled. I struggled throughout my K through 12 career. It wasn't until I was very late in middle school, just entering high school, that I actually found the theater. And for the first time in my, you know, life, I found something that I both loved and was good at. I had plenty of things that I had loved and enjoyed doing, but there was something about the theater that I also had a skill in. And finding that intersection of something that I loved and something that I was good at kind of set the trajectory for me to build ultimately what's been my career and my life's work in theater and theater education.
Okay. So now, Lisa, I mean, people would look at you. This is just kind of amazing, you know, what you just said, because you're so articulate. In fact, even just talking about mathematics and numeracy, I mean, this, you know, you're articulating with a language set that people would think, wow, this woman just has it all together. And yet to have struggled so in school, and tell us a little bit more about, because it's a young age to even be in high school and to be turned on by something that you now clearly understand resonates with who your true self is. Talk to us a little bit about when that happened. I can't even imagine how that felt.
Absolutely. You know, and it's something that I acknowledge that I had the great privilege of discovering. There is a sociologist and a scholar named Annette Leroux who wrote a book called Unequal Childhoods, who talks about the various sorts of child rearing that we see in this country. And it's specifically about different approaches to child rearing as it relates to class. And what Leroux articulates is that children in, you know, middle class or more affluent communities tend to have what she calls concerted cultivation. And that's the opportunity to attend, you know, after school theater programs or go to the theater or go to the museum or learn an instrument. And children in lower socioeconomic communities oftentimes grow up with what she calls natural growth, which is more of the sort of natural way of childhood, being able to learn and discover things on your own and have sort of unstructured free play. And there are benefits to both, right? But it's because of my parents allowing me to try a lot of different things that I was able to find this thing that I was good at. So in this instance, this sort of like concerted cultivation approach to child rearing really set me up for success. So it's at once that I'm deeply grateful for that, but also have to acknowledge the profound privilege that I had by virtue of finding that. So the real story is that, you know, one day on a long summer break, after eighth grade, my friend said, "Hey, would you help me memorize my lines? I'm in this theater program in downtown Milwaukee. I grew up in the Midwest. I'm in this theater program in Milwaukee, and I have to memorize my lines for a play." And she handed me a script and said, "Would you help me memorize my lines?" And the act of sitting across from a friend and bringing a character to life and telling a story made me immediately go home and beg my parents to enroll me in that very same theater program. And they did. And that was the moment that I discovered something that I was good at. And I think what the theater affords you is an opportunity to try on different things. You can try on different characters. You can try on different language. You can try on different stories and really learn what it is to be yourself through the act of pretending to be someone else. And for me, that was the moment that allowed me to discover theater in high school. And then ultimately rally enough to get into college. I got my grades up enough to get into college and high school and studied in high school and in college theater, and then ultimately moved to New York and started my theater career.
Okay, so you started out in this path, which, you know, I think a lot of people dream about. It's like, I'm going to be an actor. So isn't that where you kind of started out? You were going to be an actor and a director, and this was going to be your path. But how did you end up where you are today? Because it was kind of this circuitous route to get to working with these children, these underserved children in the Disney production.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think if you would have told my high school self, you know, you're going to be an arts administrator when you grow up, I would probably have felt that my dream got deferred in some way, right? But actually, my dream had evolved. And so, you know, I think like so many of us who work in the performing arts, I got bitten by the acting bug. That was the most accessible way in for me. I enjoyed it. It was fun. I went to college determined to study acting. And while I was in college, I went to Arizona State University. I had the great fortune of studying under a man named Marshall Mason, who is a very accomplished director in the American theater. And through studying under Marshall, I realized, oh, wow, you know, what I thought I wanted to be an actor, but what I'm really probably better at and what I really enjoy more is directing. So my dream evolved at that moment in time. And then after I graduated with my undergraduate degree, I was determined to move to New York and continue my education and, you know, ultimately start a theater company in New York. But before I did, for a summer, I went home and got a summer job in Wisconsin teaching at that same theater academy that introduced me to the theater at that pivotal moment in time. And what I realized then was actually what I'm best at is not just directing, but directing children. And so that really set me on the path of what is now my career, which is to, you know, ultimately try to bridge the access gap to arts education for children around the world because of the many benefits that I know it can provide.
You said a nugget in there that I just think is so important, that you said, I learned more about me by pretending to be someone else, that was what theater and acting can afford you. How did that shape knowing yourself? Because I think some people might perceive, well, in that acting and pretending, you can go further away from yourself in knowing who you are. How did that journey bring you closer to understanding, I'm not only good at this, but these are things that I incredibly value, and they're just a part of the inherent Lisa?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing because, you know, on the one hand, you know, folks see, you know, actors in movies and television and on stage, and they see people become other characters. And you kind of can instantly tell if you're watching a piece of entertainment, if you believe that character or if you don't. And in the study of acting, you know, there's one school of thought that says what acting actually is behaving truthfully in imaginary circumstances. And in order to behave truthfully in imaginary circumstances, you actually have to know yourself very, very well. So in order to authentically play a character who may be different from you, you have to find yourself within that character, right? So I think that's why it's so important for young people to have access to theater education, not just for the children who can and will go on to have careers in entertainment and bring new and interesting stories to our canon, but for all children to have a moment to examine what it means to be a person and what it means to be themselves.
So Lisa, I'm just curious. So help us explain to us, like, what does this look like and who are the kids you're working with and what are the things that you do specifically? Because it is an amazing program that you do with the kids in this thing. But how did you get specifically with the Disney program for these underserved kids?
So in my role at Disney, I am in charge of the education programming for the theatrical division. So we're the division that produces the Broadway shows. We have the national tour. If you've seen The Lion King in your town, that was brought by the division of Disney that I work for, produced by our division. So my job is to run our education and audience engagement programming, not just for folks who are coming to see our Broadway shows, but to extend the mission of our organization into communities who may not have access to it right now. And so the thing that I'm probably most proud of in my career is the program that you're alluding to, which is our Disney Musicals in Schools program. So what Disney Musicals in Schools endeavors to do is build lasting theater programs in under-resourced public elementary schools. Because when you look at the gap of who has access to things like putting on a school play and who doesn't, there's a very clear sort of socioeconomic divide. And going back to my earlier comments about this notion of, you know, which sort of groups of people are afforded access to this work and which aren't, that has big implications, not just in terms of equity of education, but also in terms of the future of our industry, who's opting into it and who's opting out, right? So there are very many compelling reasons why it's critically important that all children have access to equal opportunity to an arts education. So that's sort of why I built the Disney Musicals in Schools program. And what the program is essentially a grant program that provides performance rights to an elementary school to put on their first school musical. But instead of just giving them free rights to produce their own production of The Jungle Book or The Lion King or Aladdin, we also train the teachers how to do it. So we send in a pair of what we call teaching artists into residence to the school over the course of 6 months to work with a team of phenomenal elementary school teachers. These are general teachers, special education teachers, librarians, PE teachers, music teachers, who come together as a team and over the course of a semester, learn how to produce their first school musical. With the goal being that at the end of that semester, the students have performed their first school musical, but more importantly, their teachers have learned the foundational skills to be directors and choreographers and music directors and stage managers, so that when we're not there in the future, they can continue producing a show year after year after year. So we offer that program across the country. We started it in New York City with our own self-managed program, and have since scaled it by partnering with performing arts centers and regional theaters across the country. We now also offer the program in the UK, and we're gearing up for some more international expansion.
Oh my gosh. You know, like, it's just so exciting to hear about that programming, Lisa. It makes me want to go back to elementary school. Like, honestly, like, I wish there had been opportunities like that to unleash that kind of creativity, you know, and your passion for wanting that for all kids. And I heard you say, Lisa, one of your deep-seated values, and you've already alluded to it many times already in our short conversation, has been about this affording access and divide. And yes, this clear line of trying to bridge this haves and have-nots that you found for yourself in order to discover innately who you were. It required unleashing this creativity, theatrical, expressive space that was a part of your core self, and that you have this huge passion to unleash that for all children. I mean, it's just really, it's really remarkable to hear how clear you are about that value set. And wasn't there a time in your career where you actually kind of segued away from this theatrical pathway and this creativity pathway and were doing something else that you were becoming quite successful at?
Yeah, you know, it's a funny story because, you know, after I finished teaching that summer and realized that I was most interested in working with young people in theater, I moved to New York to sort of pursue the original dream of opening my own theater company. And I did. I moved to New York. I studied the Neighborhood Playhouse School of Theater for a moment. I met there two other women collaborators who are brilliant artists in their own right. And we got together to develop our own theater company that was sort of dedicated to producing underproduced American works by well-known American playwrights. And we did that very successfully in a very, very scrappy sort of off times 10 Broadway sort of way. And, you know, because we were, you know, a group of young artists trying to be entrepreneurial, living in an incredibly expensive city, we all had to have day jobs. And so, you know, I got a day job working in a store in Soho, selling retail, you know, selling pants. And because I showed up on time and was reliable and responsible, I started getting promoted in this retail career. And all of a sudden, I was sort of scheduling rehearsals and even whole productions around meetings about, you know, which window should we put this shirt in, which is, you know, a valid industry in its own right, just not what I had dedicated my life to. So I sort of had as so many young people in their 20s do, I sort of had my, you know, young to mid 20s crisis and realized that if I was going to work in the theater, I needed to make my income be from the theater. And that's when I just logged on to playbill.com, which is, you know, an industry site that includes so many job listings, and found an incredibly entry-level position at Disney Theatrical Group for something in general management. It was called operations assistant. And I didn't know a single person at that organization. I didn't know a single person working on Broadway at that level. And I applied for it and I got an interview and I got the job. And that's where I started my, you know, that was 15 years ago now. That's when I started my career at Disney. And at the time, we didn't have an education department. So I had the good fortune of being sort of entrepreneurial at Disney, or intrapreneurial, if you will, at Disney, and building the department up internally from there.
I think what's fascinating about this is that, you know, you took a pay cut, you took a risk, Lisa, but you were really, really focused on, you know, your true north, your true self. Not all of us are willing and able to do that. What gave you the courage to just really follow your passion and your dream?
You know, it's interesting because I look back on that time and I don't know that it felt risky. You know, there's something very liberating about being young, being single, being childless, and well, I'll just try this. And if it doesn't work, I'll go somewhere else in a year. Do you know what I mean? And so I think there was a happenstance of the moment in my career and youth that I was in, that it just felt like the next step. It just felt like the thing that I should try. And you know what, if it didn't work out, there's always something else to do. So I think looking back, it's been so pivotal in my career, but at the time it just felt like a job that got me that much closer to my ultimate goal of a career in the theater.
So I love what you talk about, Lisa, that, you know, these decisions of pursuing your authentic self, they don't have to be perceived as, you know, fatal. And you also talk about some of the characteristics of your life, right? You're single and you know, you don't have all these other obligations and child, you know, once you start adding in some of those additional responsibilities in life, it becomes more difficult in some ways, but yet this not holding back, because you could have never imagined the trajectory of now doing international theater production leadership for grade school kids everywhere.
Right.
And so, but really what you were clear about is this is what I wanted, this is where I need to go, because this is what is myself, my whole authentic self, kids and theater.
Yeah, that's right. And something that I was good at, you know, and I think oftentimes we're, you know, going back to education with a big E, we're oftentimes told to improve the things we're bad at. And there's absolute value in that. I think this act of continuous improvement is always healthy, but there's nothing wrong with finding the thing you're good at and doing that. So for me, I felt at the time that I had a pretty narrow scope of the things that I was good at, and this was one of them. So why not give it a go?
That's pretty amazing, because I'm not sure that all of us are willing, and you say it wasn't a risk, which I just find fascinating. Because I think it's pretty easy to let outside factors, job security or place-based location, to just kind of take away and guide our path going forward. And you were able to really dig in deep and say, I know this is what I want, and this is where I want to be, and I know this is what I'm good at, that led you to where you really want to be today. So, Lisa, I know your life today, you're married, you have a 5.5-year-old daughter, I believe, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And so what are the things today that are driving you and moving you forward? And where do you really see this going? I mean, where is the next step? What's the path?
Yeah, that's the great question, especially after getting this doctorate degree. Everybody looks at that and they say, all right, so why'd you do that, right? Like, what's the ultimate agenda? And it sounds so ridiculous, but there actually wasn't one, other than I wanted to be the best practitioner that I could be. And this felt like the next step that could give me those skills. But, life is very different now. I'm married. I have, as you said, a young child who just started kindergarten in the middle of a pandemic. And decisions have greater sphere of influence now, right? Where what I think I've learned the most is the most scarce and precious resource that we all have is time. And for those of us who have decided to work and raise a family and do other things, hobbies or side jobs or whatever, the thing that I'm realizing imperfectly is that you cannot be all things to all people all the time. You can't. There's not enough time in the day. There's not enough energy in us to be all things to all people all the time. And so what I'm working on right now is figuring out where my priorities have to fall and giving myself the grace to know that that can look different every day. And sometimes my work is my priority, and sometimes my family is my priority, and sometimes dabbling in watercolor is my priority. And all of those things have to work in concert, or I'm going to burn out and be a mess.
You just really have brought up the dilemma for all of us that are trying to keep all these balls in the air, right? And, we've talked a lot, Mel and I, about, it isn't about having it all at one time. It's about having it over time. And so it's really to your point of, what's my value set priority right now? What is the thing that I need to do for me, for my family, for my responsibilities, for what's exciting to me, to keep me whole? And right. I think that's something that Mel and I came into the workforce at the time when it was, you need to now add on everything that a full-time career brought and do all of the things that were other value sets brought to us by women of the past. And I'm not putting that in a positive or negative light. I'm just saying it was how it was. So you just dang near killed yourself instead of sitting down prioritizing like your own values right now at this moment. How do my values drive what I should prioritize to do in my life? And what is going to be my main focus? And I think that's how you have multiple exciting, interesting avenues that make up your life.
Yeah, I agree with you. And also disrupting sort of the self-talk. I mean, sort of the inherited generational expectation that especially I think women have on themselves. I'm very fortunate in my small family to have a partner who is more than a 50-50 partner. He does a lot for our house, much more than, the sort of typical gender expectation of what a working husband would do for a home. And that's allowed me to do things like get my doctorate degree, right? And so I need to also, one, acknowledge that I have privilege in that, and two, also sort of like check the self-talk that I often have. Like if I take a moment on a weekend and I'm, let's say I'm dabbling in watercolor and I just want to sit down for half an hour and do a little painting, I feel so guilty that I'm not spending time with my 5-year-old daughter at that moment in time, because the expectation is that I should be constantly engaging and giving myself in pursuit of her. But I have to also tell myself that what I'm showing her is that mommy is like three-dimensional, and she's a mom, and she's a scholar, and she works. And guess what? She's learning to paint, and she's pretty bad at it, but she keeps trying. And I have to let that be the monologue. Otherwise, the guilt consumes me.
Wow. You know, you've just kind of boiled it all down to, I think, what just we all struggle it. With. Oh, no kidding. Because I think it's just a daily struggle for all of us. And I don't know, but I know this for sure because I don't live inside of a male body. But I truly believe that you are right, Lisa, in that we struggle with that more as women. Just because of all those preconceived notions from years and years ago that were just kind of piled on us. I remember, you know, many years ago, probably predates you, but there was a time when, you know, it's like pictures of women who you can do it all. It's like, yeah. No, we really can't.
No.
We shouldn't be expected to.
We really can't.
No, you know, and leave us alone. You know, it's just kind of like, okay, now you can do it all, which means that you have to, you know, pile everything on top of everything. And if we didn't, and I'm just doing this personally, I would feel guilty. And sometimes I still do it to myself. So the way in which you articulated that, and think about the gift you're giving your daughter to be able to say, it's not selfish. It's just claiming who you are and claiming what you're good at. So what a gift that you've been able to do and give to her as a, you know, being a role model for her going forward. Wish we had all figured that out.
I don't know that I figured it out, but it's a constant reminder. I saw a funny, a friend of mine has a young child and she posted a funny meme on social media that said something like, you know, everyone says sleep when the baby sleeps. So then you also do laundry when the baby does laundry and you also run your business when the baby runs her business. Like you just have to like these little innocuous phrases that surround us as women. We have to constantly remind ourselves they don't work, you know?
And you know what, that the comments about guilt, Lisa and Mel, you were talking about guilt too. A long time ago, I heard about, you know, false guilt. We're holding guilt, but we call it guilt. But it's really false when it is expectations that we perceive, you know, others are putting on us or how society is or all these messages. That's just false guilt. But it's the true guilt we need to worry about when we are disconnected from what's our true values and acting not in accordance with that. So whenever I start to feel the guilt, I'm always like, is this false guilt? That's from messaging, or is this really true guilt where I am walking away from my values? So like with you painting, you're really staying true to your two values about creativity, wholeness as a woman, teaching your daughter. And the guilt is from, well, I should probably be 100% spending time with her when she's probably going to be okay learning how to self-play and free range a little bit.
That's right. Know?
So it's just interesting, all this crosstalk that we have as women. You know, Lisa, I wanted to ask you, because that trajectory from I was a little girl, I want to circle back a little bit to when you were little, and I really wasn't good in school. I really didn't know what I was good at. And when you then went from grade school and not being great at education to high school and getting turned on by theater, talking graciously and about the support of your parents and how they were trying to help you. But what were some of the messages about yourself when you felt like you were not succeeding during those years?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the academic in me immediately goes to a place of self-efficacy, which those of us who work in education or folks who have taught understand is a construct that's close to confidence, right? And it's basically your belief in your capacity to do something. And for me, that is the most foundational element of a successful and happy life. Not social problems notwithstanding, but when it comes down to, does someone believe that they're capable of doing something? That unlocks so much potential. And the way to build self-efficacy is to have small successes in something that you're good at. And the way to erode it is to constantly fail. So when we think about where we put our energies in education, this time with a capital E, if we have a limited scope of what we teach people, say literacy and math, which are incredibly important, there's a limited scope of who's going to be successful with that. And the feedback loop then becomes, I'm not successful, I can't do this, instead of, well, I'm not successful at that, but I'm great at this other thing, and what that unlocks for someone's future. So kind of circling it all together, that's why I think it's so essential that we broaden the scope of what it means to learn, both with the little e education and the big e education, so that more children have more opportunities to feel successful and build that self-efficacy.
Wow, what a powerful statement. If every child could have that opportunity to do that, we'd be in a really good place today. So truly appreciate your insight. So let's take it one step further. And before we close today, I really would ask that you would, what advice would you give to women, you know, at any stage in their life about really understanding yourself and, you know, who you are, living out your values? And what advice could you give so that we could really have this full, juicy life that we all deserve and that we all should be able to have?
Yeah, it's so funny because I always feel like, who am I to give anyone advice? I feel like a hot mess express over here, which I feel is the entire reason that you've started this business that you run and have developed these values, because that is the problem that we all say that, right? So I think my advice would be, it's sort of twofold, especially right now. And, you know, when we're recording this in 2021 and everything that's happening in the world, I think it is to extend the same grace to yourself that you extend to everybody else. Because oftentimes as women, especially women who, you know, work in certain industries, education, et cetera, our professional identity is in extending grace and opportunity and chances for improvement to others. And guess what? We can have that too. So be kind to yourself as you are kind to others, I would say. And then, like, the second bit of advice is probably a little bit more salty and less optimistic, which is, you know, there's a lot of resistance in this world to successful women and to, you know, taking that a step further, to successful women of color. And I am a white woman. I have definitely encountered sexism in my life, as I think we all have. And I don't know that that's going to go away anytime soon. But I do think if I had it to do over again, I would probably stand up to it a little bit more and more frequently. I think that's also a skill that comes with age and experience. So I don't know that I could have successfully done it. But I think I've got a boldness now that I wish I had in my 20s to be a little bit more confident in who I was, despite what the expectations are on me as a, you know, from society.
Before Deb wraps up, I just got to tell you, I'm just sitting here shaking my head. Yes. So
yes.
Thank you for that.
You've just been an amazing guest, and we could seriously talk with you all day about your thinking on these things. And I love what you ended with about, you know, both the good side and the bad side of this, but really it's about clarity for yourself about who yourself is, and then maturing the confidence to leverage it, to bring it into the world, to have it be part of a positive force. And you are just someone who is doing it in spades. And we just, it'll be so great to watch how your career unfolds. And, you know, we're hoping that we can have you come out to the plains and hang out with us someday. We would just love to
continue. Oh, that sounds amazing.
Conversation over a campfire. So we just so appreciate you, and thanks for taking the time today. And to all of our listeners, we really appreciate the time that you took to check in with Influential She. And as is our tradition, we'd like to leave you with a question. What are the messages you're telling yourself today? Are they positive and reinforcing your great values and all of your goodness and your passion that you can bring to the world? Or are you giving yourself messages that you're not enough? We're just here to tell you that's absolutely not true. And we are looking forward to working with women to unleash their magnificence out into the world. Thanks again, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of Influential She. We hope you'll do it again.
Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our podcast, we'd be so jazzed if you rate us on whatever app you use to find us. And hey, be sure to tell all your friends about Influential She.
And please visit us at InfluentialShe.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. And you know what? If you come up with a new one, please let us know. In the meantime, remember, stay influential.